Welcome back. You listen to Soundbites right here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. Lines are open at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also write us an email to talk@steinershow.org. As we start off our program today with Tim Wheeler, managing editor and project writer for the Bay Journal. Good to have you with us, Tim.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well, man. How are you doing?
I'm here.
Settling in into your new job. That's good.
I'm settled, yes.
You're settled. That's good. That's good. That's good. So let's jump right into it. In a little while, we'll talk about the Pollinator Protection Act, but I'll leave that up for a moment. But let's talk about where the legislature was on these issues. In a positive vein, you can talk a bit about what passed, though I'm as interested in the things that didn't pass for a number of reasons. But like Program Open Space is back again.
Sure. Yeah. Program Open Space, the funding stream, dedicated funding stream for preserving open land and farmland in Maryland, has been sort of on the books since 1969, but repeatedly this stream of money has been raided by governors and legislatures to help balance the budget. The General Assembly this year didn't quite put that program in a lockbox, as some had hoped, but they did put some tighter purse strings on it so that if money is taken in the future to help balance the budget, it has to be repaid within 3 years, or there has to be a plan to do that within 3 years, which is, up until this point, it was basically a voluntary thing. Governors and legislatures would put some of the money back, but a lot was left on the table, something on the order of close to, hundreds of millions of dollars over the years, if you look back, that were diverted and have not been put back to preserving land.
So this is, and that's a really good thing. And two of the other bills here I want to ask you about that strike me as what happens a lot, and you can comment on this any way you'd like, but the Greenhouse Gas Emissions Reduction Act, reauthorization that Barvey and Pinsky put in, saying that 25% of Maryland gas emissions would be gone by the year 2020. But again, this bill plus another bill, which was put in by Delegate Frick and Senator Pugh, Clean Energy Renewable Energy Standards Revisions, did a similar thing to say significant to raise the amount of energy Maryland gets from renewable sources by 20% by 2022. But then in both bills, there are no teeth.
This is true. They're aspirational goals. There's no requirement. The truth is under the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act that was originally passed in 2009, the Department of the Environment issued a report, I guess, last year that said basically we're pretty much on track to do that with a lot of help from the economy. But there has been a lot of progress in terms of greater efficiency out there. Part of that came through programs that were funded through the ratepayer base to encourage energy efficiency. The two bills together do work hand in hand, raising the renewable portfolio standard, requiring more renewable energy to be part of our energy mix here in Maryland, does push to keep fossil fuels out of the mix and to reduce them. And there is. A couple teeth in that, but I guess a big piece of that was left on the table this time was the proponents had wanted to pair that with a job training bill that would ensure that there would be economic benefits throughout the community on that, and that was just too much for the legislature to swallow this time.
Yeah,
and just, by the way, it's not absolutely sure at this point, unless I've missed it, that the governor's going to sign that renewable portfolio standard bill.
He may not sign this bill.
He's never made a statement or a stand on it.
So, I mean, any indication where the governor is on this at all?
It's hard to say. The governor, if from the days he campaigned for office, has said basically he likes renewable energy. He's a big proponent of efficiency. He doesn't believe that ratepayers should have to pay any more money though for their power. And typically, these programs have been funded by a small bump up in your rates in order to provide funding to provide loans and grants. To get to be efficient, generally you have to invest some money, put some more insulation in your house, pay somebody to seal the leaks and that sort of thing. They got to pay some money up front. And the one way to sort of help people get over that was to provide these grants or rebates, typically, and then more people would sign up for it. It's sort of a work in progress there, but they have been averse to raising the rates to do that sort of thing. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean that's in some of these bills. That's what always kind of strikes me is how we there's nothing inside these bills that ensures that we're actually going to meet the goals we're talking about, or prepares people to have these new jobs. I mean that to me is a big piece of this.
No. I mean that's part of where folks like you and I have to sort of hold their feet to the fire and keep shining a spotlight on how we're doing.
Amen to that. So let's talk about some of the things that didn't get out of committee that I found interesting, and then some other ones that I found also interesting around transportation. Mm-hmm. There is the one of the things we covered a lot over the last few years is this whole notion of poultry litter management. Right. And this is a bill that would mean that the Purdue's, the Tyson's, and others would be responsible for the cost of transporting excess poultry manure out, and it would be their responsibility, not the farmers. This is caused, but this never even made out of committee, did it? So tell us the story.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting development here, and a couple of sort of, believe it or not, all environmentalists don't think alike. And
right.
there's a pretty broad spectrum of views about sort of how to deal with farming. And there are those sort of on one extreme, you might say, is Food and Water Watch, which, thinks that, that they've been advocates of taxing chickens in the past to sort of help pay for dealing with poultry litter management. And on this, one might argue on the less extreme or more conservative side of the Bay Foundation, which has always tried to sort of partner with farmers and work with them. Rather than sort of be adversarial, the two of those groups got together and said, basically we think that it's time, especially now that the phosphorus management tool, this regulation that basically has put some restrictions on how much manure can be put on some of the farm fields, many farm fields on the eastern shore, perhaps it's time that we sort of devise a system that's going to help protect farmers from having to bear the burden of dealing with that, and the fact is that the growers, the people raising the chickens, are doing it on contract to the processors, so they thought we should make them at least responsible, if not liable, for the manure there. The bill was attacked by pretty broad environmentalist support. It got attacked by the farm community, and it was opposed by the Hogan administration. The farm community took it, took very hard and basically accused these environmental groups of turning on them, of going after them again. The telling argument was everybody, the opponents, argued that it was premature, that this phosphorus management tool has yet to be fully implemented. It doesn't really fully kick in until 2022, I think. So it's, 5 or 6 years off.
Right.
And that they haven't even gotten a full reading yet of how much of the eastern shore in particular is going to be judged to be so saturated now with phosphorus in the soil that you shouldn't put any more on. There's some preliminary data that came out during the hearings, which sort of went in the opponent's favor because the initial reports coming in from farmers, and they were fragmentary, large chunks of the shore had not reported yet, that there was perhaps less oversaturated soils out there than initially estimated. That can be a little misleading because it really matters where those soils are. If you only have 10% of your soils are oversaturated, if they're next to the waterways, you've still got a big problem.
So, and as you look at this particular issue, I'm curious. I mean, what do you think what do you think we're missing here?
Well, I guess the question is, is there a problem with poultry manure, with putting manure on fields or not? And I think the answer clearly is yes, still there's a problem. The question is how big and how it can be managed. That was always the issue with this, and that was part of the resistance that the agriculture community put up to the phosphorus management tool to begin with, was they argued that it was going to be incredibly disruptive and that they were, it's going to destroy a way of life on the eastern shore. I seem to recall Governor Hogan making those kinds of arguments during the campaign. He ultimately came around to the idea that they could put this tool on it, that they would work with the farmers. Now, the initial statements coming out of the Hogan Agriculture Department are that maybe this isn't so disruptive after all, that we can manage this, and we don't need to, completely change the industry in order to protect the environment on the shore. You know, I guess the question is, you know, have we really flipped the switch here on this to where it's not such a big deal after all, or is there somewhere in the middle? I think only time can and further investigation can tell us the answer to that. But it is pretty striking how much the sort of the tone of the rhetoric has changed here in a year's time.
So very quickly, I was interested also that I remember we covered this last year a bit, that the use of antimicrobial drugs with cattle and pigs and poultry was put in by Delegate Robinson and Senator Pinsky. Also, and they had a committee that went through all this in 2015, but the bill to kind of regulate these antibiotics that could be, some people argue and some science argues, drug-resistant bacteria in livestock could be dangerous for all of us and for the water, soil, and air, didn't even get out of committee either. I mean, there was – didn't. Yeah. So, I mean, it seems to me, I don't know what pejorative about this, but there's a lot of these bills, it seems, when they have this kind of industry opposition that, I mean, that has a lot to do with, but some people could purport that it has a lot to do with why these things don't come out of committee.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the argument made in both cases, and maybe the telling argument for those who were sort of on the fence or who weren't sort of heavily invested in this, you got to remember that on these kinds of issues, the vast majority of the legislators are really pretty much, you know, in the middle. They don't really, you know, they don't count themselves as ardent environmentalists or, you know,
right,
maybe
right.
Everybody likes farming. So when they start hearing these opposition, they try to sort of compromise, or they try to find the path of least resistance, if you will, or the thing that would do the least, you know, harm to the status quo. In both cases, the ag community argued that these things were at best premature. And antimicrobials, the argument there was somewhat the same argument was used on the pesticide bill, on the neonicotinoid bill, that basically this is something that the federal government is already dealing with. However, you know, slowly and perhaps inadequately. I mean, there is regulatory action on the federal front to deal with this, but you know, it's taking its sweet time. You know, at the same time, you know, perhaps because of market pressures, because they recognize the trend. You know, some producers like Purdue had already sort of pledged basically to stop using antibiotics and stop. They said they had stopped doing it in their chicken. And in fact, you know, you buy it at the store, it proudly proclaims it's basically organic. They don't quite call it that, but hormone free and all that other stuff. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's the argument was that basically there was that this was the bill that was. Unneeded, at least unless and until the federal government completes its regulatory action on this.
So, just finally here, there are a lot of things here that didn't come through. Some of the transportation bills didn't come up under the Maryland Open Transportation Decision Act, which is a ranking system whether that was the override. But then there was this other bill. I found interesting, which was reducing environmental degradation for the underserved through community engagement,
right.
Called the Reduce Act, which meant that businesses, when they go into low, put diesel trucks through low income and minority neighborhoods, would have to negotiate with the neighborhood and talk about how to get that done better without hurting the health of the neighborhood. That also didn't get out of committee, right?
That's true, and this is a bill that's banged its head against the door to be heard and to get considered on the floor for. At least the past couple of years, you know, there are communities out there that you know, are sort of ringed by various kinds of polluting and dirty businesses and industries, and there's a great deal of frustration that each one, when it comes up to get a permit, is sort of considered almost in isolation. And the argument was that, you know, the cumulative impact of these things should be considered, and that there should be some greater community input into these things. You know, sometimes it isn't just the point source of the factory or the business, but it's also all the traffic, the diesel truck traffic that is brought with it that should be considered. It did not fly, and it's I think again perhaps the complexity of it is a challenge. Now the proponents would tell you, as they did with Poultry Litter Management Act, that right. Sometimes it takes 2 or 3 years to get something through the legislature. That you have to do an education process and you have to do a negotiation process. This one hasn't. Seem to show a whole lot of sign of progress, so we'll see.
Tim, I appreciate the time you take with us here. We're about to turn the conversation to Bonnie Raindrop, who's in the studio, who's legislative chair for the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. You're welcome to kind of chime in here if you like, but I don't want to hold you here.
That's all right. Could I make a plug for one other bill that you didn't mention that I think is pretty significant, albeit at this point,
sure,
pretty general? That was a bill that requires a study of how many oysters we have in the bay. Regulating oyster harvest for many years by basically regulating inefficiency into the harvest. That's sort of going away. Oystermen are getting more and more efficient with dredging the oysters, but we've never really determined how many they could safely take. And there was a big fight over that. Ultimately, it was compromised, but the agreement was to actually try to get a study and to determine what the sustainable level of harvest in the future.
That is critical. I want to come back to that in some greater detail again in coming weeks. Tim Wheeler is managing editor and project writer for the Bay Journal. Tim, thank you so much once again for being with us. Appreciate it. And thank you for the work you're doing.
Take care.
Bonnie Raindrop, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, Mark. It's great to be here.
We've been talking about the bee issue and neonicotinoids a lot. So talk about the bill that did pass and
we're really
didn't go all the way, but
thrilled about the Pollinator Protection Act was passed, an overwhelming bipartisan majority, which was very encouraging. And the bill will take a very important step towards protecting all pollinators, not just bees, but birds, butterflies, and lots of insects that pollinate our food that we don't even think about. And the way it'll do that is that there's been a whole flood of these products in the home garden market that contain this class of pesticides called neonics. And most of us go into the stores, we don't even realize that we're buying products that will just basically kill everything in our garden. So this will take those products off the market, off of our store shelves in Maryland by 2018. So that will make a substantial step towards reducing the amount of toxics that our pollinators will encounter.
But this bill only covers what you and I buy.
It doesn't cover
what professional lawn people and others use or larger nurseries use, correct?
That's correct. And there was a portion of the bill that we didn't get this year that we hope to make people aware of and try to go back for, which is to label all the plant materials that we buy in garden centers.
That didn't pass.
It did not. We go in and we buy bee-friendly plants to try to help pollinators, but a study from Friends of the Earth found that over half of these plants are already contaminated with this toxic chemical. So we're doing the very thing that we think is going to help the bees and it can actually harm them. So it's really important to ask when you buy plants.
So tell us, where does this bring us? I mean, what does this new bill say? So, and tell us exactly what it does.
Well, as I said, it takes all of these chemicals that, contain neonics. And you can't just go into a store and identify easily that it contains this class of pesticide. There are about 8 different chemical names. So it's very hard for consumers to know what they're buying. But it will remove these from store shelves starting in January of 2018. And this is really significant because we've seen a dramatic decrease in our bees. We've lost 60% last year of the beehives in Maryland.
60%?
Yeah. The year before it was 50%. And it's been a big jump, and it correlates to a flood of these products hitting store shelves in the same time period. So we really feel like by removing these, we're giving bees, birds, butterflies, even molting blue crabs, and the whole life cycle that we need to all live and eat, we're giving them a good chance.
Because it's not just about flowers, because the pollinators pollinate everything. I mean, 60% of all the vegetables we eat are pollinated plants.
Yes. One in three bites of food, really the most nutritious parts of our diet, require a pollinator to not only pollinate it once, but multiple times. And we heard from farmers who testified for this bill that their tomato crops and squash crops and all the vegetables that they grow on the Eastern Shore were being dramatically reduced because they didn't have even the native bumblebees to come in that they normally have to pollinate.
So this means that all those products are now banned from the stores? Is that what it means?
As of January 2018.
So that'll mean you cannot buy what?
You won't be able to go into your garden store, grocery store, or any place like that and buy products that contain the neonic chemicals. And these are different from what we normally buy. When we put a pest control chemical on our plants, we usually expect it to be gone in a couple of days. But this is a different class because it's systemic, that it can be in the soil conditioner, it can be on coated seeds, it can be in the trees that we buy. Everything can have this in it in multiple ways, and it will make the plant toxic for years. It expresses the poison through the fruits and the pollen and the nectar. So it's a very different thing because it's so persistent.
So it's not just what we would put on the things we grow. It's anything we buy.
Pretty much. We have to really ask. Like I said, 50% of the plants sold in home and garden stores in Maryland were already pre-treated with this poison.
So now that we've won this battle in terms of what people can personally use in their gardens, where's the next phase? I mean, where do you go next?
Well, I think the next phase is going to be to make sure that the stores are labeling plants, seeds, and seedlings if they have been pre-treated. It's a consumer right to know issue.
What about the other issue of commercial companies that do lawn care and do all the other and create this for commercial industry? They're not covered in any of this. I mean, that must
they're
take
not.
A large percentage of what we're talking about, right?
Yes, but it's a little bit different with, I have a big bottle of this stuff sitting on the counter.
What's it, Bear what?
Bear Rose and Flower Care.
Yes, right.
It's like a half a gallon of it. It's so easy for all of us to overuse this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the writing on this label is so tiny you need a magnifying glass. And if you only need a cap full of this and like 2 gallons of water, and, you know, you have this big half a gallon thing here, we wind up finding that as homeowners, we inadvertently are overusing this stuff so that our landscapes become killing fields for pollinators. Now, a lot of the other farmers, veterinary uses, and lawn care companies have to train and certify in how to use these chemicals. So the potential for, overuse is one of the things that we're being able to cut back on with this bill.
It took a long time to get here, I know. We only had about a minute left in the segment. It took a long time to get here. I remember when I first interviewed the new Secretary of Agriculture, he didn't even agree that this was a problem.
Yes.
So
tremendous research has come out about it, an overwhelming amount of data. And, this is a great citizen action story. People should really take heart that this is a place where our government can really work well. We see so much dysfunction in Washington, but this is a story where one person, Ruth Berlin from Maryland Pesticide Education Network, saw the need, talked to a lot of people, built a coalition of 75 organizations all working together, beekeepers, farmers, public health people, scientists, environmental groups, and everyone worked to educate about this. And it worked. It was great. You know, we went in to visit legislators and they were genuinely interested. They asked good questions. We could educate them. So this is something that we all can make a difference on in our gardens and also in our government.
And to show the power people can do, even if it takes a while to get there.
Yes.
So Bonnie Raindrop is legislative chair for the Central Maryland Beekeepers Association. Bonnie, thanks for dropping by the studio.
Thanks so much.
Good to have you here. We have to take a short break, but when we come back, we continue our conversations here on Soundbites, including the Baltimore Office of Sustainability's new citywide sustainability plan and a Passover recipe from Michael Twitty. Stay with us.
You.
We're about to have a conversation here about the Baltimore Office of Sustainability and the new work being done. We've been covering this on and off, I guess, since 2009 when it all began. We're joined now by Kristen Baja, who is Climate Resilience Planner and Floodplain Manager for the Baltimore Office of Sustainability, and Earl Johnson, who is Executive Director of the Come Home Baltimore Foundation, and Oliver, Community Leader. Good to have you both in the studio.
Thank you.
So a lot has changed, I know, in the last 9 years. You had a lot of plans about how we were going to cut back on fossil fuels and change energy. We can talk a bit about that, where that's come to. Makes me think of a very funny thing that the first time we interviewed folks from the office, they came back and said, we started
thought about changing the word sustainability, because we went into communities and interviewed people about sustainability in their communities, and people in the poorer communities in Baltimore said, you want to sustain this?
Yeah,
right?
I can see that.
I think that there are a lot of people who may not have heard previous broadcasts or know about this. So maybe Kristen, you can begin to talk a little bit about what the Baltimore Office of Sustainability is, just to get a sense.
Sure.
Understand what's going on.
Absolutely. So the Baltimore Office of Sustainability is focused on trying to make Baltimore a better place to live, a more sustainable and resilient place to live, by focusing sort of on the three tenets of sustainability, which is the environment, the economy, and sort of social networks, and making sure that we're bringing all those together when we're doing planning and also how we're doing implementation or how we're working with communities. So it's a big focus of ours to work with people, work with members of the community, make sure that the community voice is heard, and that helps direct the work that we're doing in all three of those areas. And then our job is really to make the connections between all three of those areas. So if we're doing something that's really focused on the environment, how is that going to make the economy better, and how is that also going to make our social systems better? And trying to identify that connectivity and make Baltimore a better place overall.
So let's talk about what that means in reality, right, where we are. I mean, because I know that there were – we were joking a little bit, but in the beginning they were – when this all began, there were ideas about climate change and really cutting back on our fossil fuel use and – and but that really hasn't happened. Or has it?
Yeah, we actually have made some progress in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. We've been doing a lot of work around buildings and programs that are based on sort of peer-to-peer networking to get people to make different decisions around energy use and upgrading their homes just by doing simple things like replacing light bulbs. We've had some really good programs come in, such as the Baltimore Energy Challenge and the Baltimore Energy Initiative, that both provide opportunities for provide supplies for actually making those changes, but then also offer sort of tax incentives or other affordable loan programs, cool roof programs that are really helping with retrofitting buildings and lowering our greenhouse gas emissions.
So how does it affect communities like Oliver? I mean, what happens there?
It's funny you say that, because I was just thinking, she said, yes, we have made reductions in greenhouse gases, but what does that mean for my community?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well,
right.
What that means is that climate change is still happening, right? So we're already feeling the effects of climate change, especially in poorer neighborhoods. So you take those downpours that we've been having, those once-in-100-year storms that seem to be happening every single week, and you put that in a poor neighborhood, and what you have is flooded basements. You have moldy houses. You have leaky roofs. You have people who basically are not prepared to prepare for the change in the environment. 10,000 years ago, cavemen were able to move when the environment changed. Today, we are less prepared. The people cannot pick up and move when the environment changed. And I think that's where sustainability comes in, is getting the community ready and prepared for that change.
So is this process changing the definition of what we mean by sustainability? I mean, it's an environmental word that has been thrown out that meant everything from buying food locally to dealing with greenhouse gases, and often kind of separate from the reality of where most people are on the ground.
I don't know if I would say it's separate from where people are on the ground. I mean, I think greenhouse gas emissions reduction is a really difficult concept.
The approach and the work often was almost ethereal in its approach. It wasn't really into the communities and doing work. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a lot of work that's happening, and I think Earl's been involved in a lot of that as well. But what we're doing with increasing the tree canopy and working on planting trees, or going in and retrofitting our stormwater systems, or making sure that we're reutilizing vacant lots for different green typologies, trying to identify opportunities for green jobs and getting people trained to be able to install solar panels on rooftops. There's a lot of small programs that are happening, or small initiatives that really are on the ground, that are these baby steps that we need to make in order to become a more sustainable city.
Yeah, our communities aren't going anywhere.
Right.
When you look at poor neighborhoods, you think about what we don't have, but we still have a lot. You know, we have plenty of green space. How do we preserve that green space for our kids, future generations? We have beautiful trees. How do we preserve and increase that tree canopy so that when we do have those hot heat days, that our communities are prepared for those? It's about passing down what we have in our community to our next generation, but that starts now, and we have to enjoy what we already have. So it's enjoying what we have and making sure that our kids can enjoy it too.
So Earl, what is the Come Home Baltimore Foundation?
Come Home Baltimore, the company, is a small developer that exclusively works in Oliver. The foundation ensures that that developer's mission stays community-minded. Ensure that the developer is not just there to create wealth for the company, but to create wealth for the community. And I think that's very important.
Interesting.
I want to also put on there, if we can, that Earl serves on the Commission for Sustainability, which is a really great group of folks that kind of work all around the city in different areas with different institutions, different for-profits and nonprofits that help make the connection between sustainability and those different networks and different stakeholders. And Earl's been an active member of the commission, and we've got a lot of great community members on that commission as well.
So how things changed since 2009 when this began?
Oh, we've had a lot of changes since 2009, a lot of different initiatives moving forward. We've definitely done some great work in urban agriculture. I think Earl can speak directly to that and some of the changes in Oliver. We've done a lot around energy and climate, a lot around climate preparedness, making sure our communities have access to resources that they need and places to go. We've done a lot around sort of the greening and connecting these and making an interconnected green network within the city and trying to think about how we utilize all of our vacant lots and how do we utilize them for something good and see them as assets. Doing wonderful work with schools and working on a better curriculum for kids around sustainability and resiliency. And, you know, continuing to consider how can we make this city a better place to be, a better place to live, and meeting the needs of all individuals. And that's really what we've been moving forward on. And Earl, you could talk to some of that.
Yeah, if you come to Oliver, you can actually see sustainability. We have two very large farms, which we're producing all types of vegetables. And that's just not just having a garden, but it's being prepared for when we don't have access to that food. During an emergency, if we don't have access to a grocery store, where do we go? We have those things already prepared in Oliver. When it comes down to having disaster plans and disaster kits, we have a very robust CERT team that's prepared to react.
A what team?
CERT team. That's a community emergency response team.
Emergency response team. What does that mean?
It's a team that's trained by the Office of Emergency Management to help respond to disasters in case the city, the police, or fire can't be there. And that's about being sustainable, being able to sustain yourself without the help of the government. So that's what we have in Oliver. We're preparing ourselves for the eventuality of change in the environment or any given day.
And that connects back to a bunch of the programs or the initiatives that are coming from the office. So we did actually a program with Earl that was Make a Plan, Build a Kit, Help Each Other. That was really working with individuals in the community to make emergency plans and build emergency kits. But the Help Each Other piece was really the most important part of identifying what assets existed in the community and then what shortcomings and really where we can strengthen community ties so that the community can respond on its own but also begin to proactively plan on its own. So that was a key one. And, you know, I think the Urban Farms program and really, you know, making sure that we're utilizing those vacant spaces for more useful production in the community, those are all connected and tied in. So those are just some of the steps that are being made.
Mm-hmm.
So the farm you talked about.
Yeah.
In Oliver. So is it growing food to feed the community? Is that what you're doing? Are they growing it?
It's to feed people who can't afford to get healthy food. Is to generate jobs for people who want to be able to sell to local restaurants. Or we have a deal with setting up with a salsa company, which some of that food will go to a salsa company and the money will go to the residents who are growing. They put it back into the farm. It's not just about giving away food, but teaching people how to utilize the land they have in their community.
So who owns the farms?
The residents do.
The community does.
Yeah, the community does. The land is through the Adopt a Lot program the city has. Nonprofit adopts the land, and then the community rallies around the resources and grants that are available, and you put up one of those plastic hoop houses, you bring in the material, and the community works the land.
So it's interesting. It just seems to be happening more and more across the city. I mean, we'll be hearing about the folks from Park Heights and the work they're doing. And they have their own farm in Park Heights. And they started a CSA where they actually have an affordable CSA for people in the community. I mean, these kind of things are really critical. So how much so how does that fit into your long-range plans? I'm curious how this particular aspect fits into the long-range plans of the Office of Sustainability. That's part of what people have to go through, right, to get the land? Am I right about that or wrong about that?
Well, I mean, the Office of Sustainability is trying to offer the opportunities for folks to be able to do these things and the pathways for success. So not only offering sort of the different policies or programs that are going to help with acquiring the lands or the tax incentives or making sure that we're making the connections with members of the community that do want to utilize that space, but then also trying to provide resources and support, continuing resources and support to ensure that it's not something that happens just for that year, but that it's an ongoing effort that will continue and, you know, as long as the community wants it to.
So I felt a shift. I mean, I know that when this began, people from the Office of Sustainability were going to different communities and interviewing people involving thousands of people and what they saw that the city wanted a bunch of years back. That'd be almost 7 years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, but I understand there's a shift going on now. I mean, you're in another process of doing a similar thing, but different. You had a town meeting recently.
What we're looking to do this time around is actually provide a training to residents and business owners where they are going out and having conversations with people about sustainability and collecting stories from people about what's important to them in becoming a more sustainable city. So instead of that voice being from the office is providing the toolkit and the resources for members of the community to have the conversation on their own in whichever way they choose. That can be through spoken word. It can be through a conversation at the barbershop. It can be something at a bus station or community meeting, any way that works best to have that conversation, to try to gather stories, to try to understand where people are right now and what they're hoping for in the future.
And then what to do with these stories? If you have the stories, then what?
it's going to be bringing them together and really identifying what are the themes? What are we really hearing that people want? And how do we prioritize our funding and our support for those themes to make sure that folks are again getting that support, getting the access to the resources. But then if there are any big policy changes or other things that we need to work on, we're identifying those for the office to move forward with.
Yeah, what we heard during the riots where people seemed like they didn't have a voice. Everyone said, I don't have a voice.
Right.
And I think the Office of Sustainability has really picked up on that. People want to be heard. You can't just make a plan and not include the people. And that's people from a broad spectrum. You can't just go to the poor neighborhoods. You can't just go to the rich neighborhoods. You have to try to reach everyone and include their voice in this plan. I think they really get it this time, that people want to be heard.
Now, I'm curious about your new – or your altered or new, however I want to put it, and I mean that in a positive sense, plan is for the future. I mean, what your long-range plan is with this. I mean, I was thinking about Clark Peters, who – has a house here in Charles Village, who was in The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
When he was living here full-time, one of his ideas was he was trying to get the city to say, put solar panels on every roof in Charles Village so we can begin to alter how we do things. It didn't go anywhere, but that was, I thought, a very creative and not a crazy idea. Yeah. So, I mean, how do the ideas like that and what you see – it's probably would be a political battle because you work there, you can't get into so much. But I mean, but you could probably get into it more than she could get into it. but so how do things like that fit into what you see for the future when we talk about resiliency and sustainability?
Yeah, I think there are these ideas of having long-range goals, really large, broad goals that are identified in collaboration with a number of stakeholders who are all going to be involved in making Baltimore more sustainable and resilient. Identifying where we want to be. Is it a zero-waste community? I mean, that if that's the goal, we really have to work hard on that, and it's not going to happen in the next 10 years. It's going to be a multi-year process. But what are the steps then we need to take in order to become that zero waste city. Same thing with greenhouse gas emissions reduction or increasing our tree canopy or making a better green network. All of those are sort of long range goals that we want and that we've heard that people want. And then we need to identify the steps that we take to get there. And sustainability is very broad. It ranges all over the place. So we're talking about transportation. We're talking about housing. We're talking about climate. We're talking about education, all of the pieces, bringing it together. And I think what we're looking to do with this process is really, you know, understand what folks want in all of those categories and then identify what are the steps that we take in order to get to those long range goals.
What are the visions like for that in communities like Oliver?
Well, I was just listening to what she was saying. It's about introducing those ideas. And I think that's what we've been missing. The ideas have been stuck up somewhere higher up where it hasn't been attainable for everyone else. Bringing those ideas down and allowing people to decide whether or not they want them or not. Mm-hmm. Solar on every house may not be effective in Oliver, but using the green space for community solar, where we sell our energy back to the energy company and make right. money off of it, might work for us. But we won't know unless those ideas are introduced to us so that we'll be able to vote or have a voice on what we want in our community.
We had a program earlier this week with a number of community activists who represent returning citizens and others in our communities. And very much part of that conversation was the power has to reside in the communities to determine how it is they need to function and want to function from the community sense, right. not mm-hmm. being told from on high how you're supposed to do it.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think one of the key things that we're hoping with the Sustainability Ambassador Network that is being created and the idea that we're training hundreds of people, providing free trainings on equity and inclusion and justice, trainings on sustainability and resiliency, providing these toolkits is that we want this continued engagement. We want them to be not just for this plan process, but then also to be ones who are going out and helping with implementation, to volunteer, to say, this is what I want to take control of in my community or my neighborhood and move forward, and this is how we'll be involved. So it's continuing to utilize that network beyond just the plan development process, but really moving forward for long term and bringing people back in and making sure we're reaching more voices and you know, more people overall.
So I'm people who are listening to us now, you have already had your town meeting. So mm-hmm. So I'm curious, and we'd like to talk to you about that in the future, how that went. But with what is – talk about the outreach and how people can be connected to the work you're doing and how you're trying to connect to them before we –
You want to take that?
Yeah.
Okay. The way that we're really trying to do this outreach is actually pretty organically on the ground. Is we held initially a supper where we invited members of the commission, such as Earl, and then members from our office to invite people that they knew who were you know, interested in making Baltimore more sustainable or didn't know anything and wanted to come learn. We hosted the supper and asked folks to then invite three of their friends. And it's sort of the way that we're conducting this outreach now is say, you know, invite three more of your friends, invite three more people you think you might be interested. So it's organic, it's on the ground, and it allows people to volunteer if it's something that they want to be involved with. What we're doing now is kind of providing more resources about this is what the training would be for to become an ambassador. Are you interested in that? Here are the tools that you would have. Here are the trainings that we can provide so that there are other things that people are getting out of this in addition to, you know, fun little incentives here and there. But in that continued engagement.
So how do people get involved or get in touch with you or you?
Yeah, so the Baltimore Office of Sustainability has a website. It's baltimoresustainability.org. And we are going to have opportunities after the town hall events, so when this airs, for folks to go online and actually volunteer to be a sustainability ambassador. And there's also a lot more information online about the plan update, the timeline, the process, and how to be involved.
Yep.
It was good to have you all here. This is great. You just heard Kristen Baja, who is a climate and resilience planner and floodplain manager for the Baltimore Office of Sustainability, and Earl Johnson, who is executive director of Come Home Baltimore Foundation, Oliver Community Leader. Thank you both.
Thank you
for having us.
We're about to hear another one of our incredible recipes here on Soundbites. We are joined by Michael Twitty, who's a culinary historian, a Hebrew school teacher, a man who brings his African and Hebrew cultures together in more unique ways than anybody that I know. And Michael Twitty, welcome. Good to have you with us again.
Hey, always a pleasure.
So Passover is upon us.
Yep.
one of the most important holidays in the Jewish world, commemorating the liberation of Jews from Egypt and the trek through the desert and Exodus and Moses, and whether they actually left Egypt or not, who cares? It's the holiday that is celebrated to talk about many other deep things.
Yeah.
So talk to us about this holiday for you, and what kind of what are you going to bring to the table, literally and figuratively?
Well, Passover is my favorite holiday. It's my favorite holiday, period. I think it's my favorite holiday because the dialogue at the table. If you're at the right Seder, I mean, if you're at the little kid Seder, you know, it's going to last an hour, then you need to eat, you're going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're at the Seders that I go to that start, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock at night and last until 2, 3 in the morning, 80% of the time is spent on dialogue talking about what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to not have constraints? What does it mean to not be conceited? What does it not mean to be sour? You know, we get rid of the matzah, we get rid of the chametz, which is the leaven, the sour part of our identities, the sour part of our lives, in exchange for matzah, this, you know, hardtack of the desert. And that's incredible. You know, that's an incredible thought. You know, you get rid of freedom means going back to the simplest, most basic, and often uncomfortable. And believe me, if you've eaten, you know, the full 8 days of matzah, you know the meaning of uncomfortable. You know.
I like matzah.
Matzah is great the first 2 days. I mean, I actually avoid it. I don't eat matzah in any form for the majority of the year, Mark. I'm telling you, I avoid it like the plague. Only because you're supposed to, like, the first time you taste the matzah on Passover, it's supposed to be a novel experience. So I don't really do, like, matzah as a, you know, soup cracker or anything like that. And the first 2 days is fantastic. After that, I really could leave it alone. But speaking of matzah, I have two Seder plates I have around during the Passover season. Whether I go to someone's house, I bring it. If it's my house, which is not often, I'll have these two Seder plates out. So, you know, typical, you know, Passover symbols are the egg, which symbolizes life and spring and all that kind of good stuff and cycles, and also the temple sacrifices. And then there's the matzah, of course, which symbolizes journey from slavery to freedom. And, you know, the myth about not having enough time. Well, guess what, Mark? I'm a culinary historian. Poor people didn't have leavened bread.
Mm-hmm.
This is called lechem oni, which means the bread of the poor, the bread of affliction for a reason. So it's not supposed to be leavened. So the idea here is that time is the most important resource. That's where our richness comes from, having the time to do these things, that time to experience life. There's this ruah, which is the, you know, the lamb's bone, symbolizes sacrifices again. And then there's the hazeret, which is horseradish, you know, your horseradish. And sometimes maror is the horseradish too, but sometimes people do one's romaine lettuce and one's horseradish, whatever they want to do. Haroset is the apples and the nuts and the fruit. I can't eat nuts anymore, but that's okay. It's a sweet date or apple mixture, depending on where you come from in the Jewish world. And of course, there's the karpas, which is the spring vegetable. So in my tradition, my African-American Jewish mix-up, the karpas is not just the parsley or the celery or the potato, because, you know, I bet you your folks, Mark, back in Eastern Europe used potato.
Yeah.
And you know why? Because there was no parsley growing in Poland at this time of the year. That's why. They didn't have anything else. But my African-American karpas, because I'm a slavery interpreter, and I work a lot with the culinary history of slavery, is the sweet potato. And I use that to stand in the place the yams of our ancestors when they were in West Africa. The egg was a sacrifice given to Almighty God in Ghana. And it symbolizes that we may be, you know, afflicted by things, but we get harder, we get stronger. It's like the egg when it hard boils. The haroset for me is not the apples and wine and nuts. It's molasses and peanuts, so molasses and pecan. And that symbolizes both the sweetness and the horror of living in the South. Because those two extremes are what created the beautiful blues, the beautiful food culture, the beautiful spiritual culture that the Black Southerner gave as a gift to him, gift to the world, not just America. And for the maror, I use collard greens.
Hmm.
I mean, we can't beat that. I mean, that's the Bible and the bitterness of slavery all in one symbol. The hazeret, instead of horseradish, is the hot red pepper. Because, you know, you can't have black food without hot pepper. But you also can't have life without spice.
Uh-huh.
And for that lamb's bone, I use the chicken bone. And that's self-explanatory. If you don't know what I mean, it's like Louis Armstrong. If you don't know what I mean, then you got to need to go get a history lesson. And then the matzah is the hoe cake. The white. Now, I know Ashkenazi don't do corn and rice on Pesach, but
I follow Sephardic customs, so I do. And that white cornmeal hoe cake is our heart attack of slavery. So these two symbols side by side mean a lot to me.
Give us your what Passover recipe you bring to the table today.
Well, I'm going to quickly go over a recipe I have for West African brisket. So this recipe is pretty much the standard, forgive me, vegans and vegetarians, this the standard Passover delicacy is the brisket. That's the highlight of the evening after you've had all this wine and matzah and, you know, you snacked on parsley. And then you roll to the substantial. So this brisket is based on, you know, both Jewish and West African foodways. So very quickly, you need a teaspoon of ginger, a tablespoon of paprika, black pepper, a teaspoon of coarse black pepper, a teaspoon of cinnamon, a teaspoon of chili powder, a teaspoon of cayenne pepper, a tablespoon of kosher salt. Now, if you use a kosher brisket, you probably don't need that much kosher salt, to be honest with you, because they're already, you know, salted and then soaked. So there's probably a lot of sodium in there as already. You need a 5-pound brisket. You need 4 cloves of garlic that have been peeled and minced. You need 4 tablespoons of olive oil. You need 3 onions that have been peeled and diced. You need 3 bell peppers, green, red, and yellow. You know, we got to have those colors, man. You got to have that color. The black, the red, and the green, right? And the yellow if you're Jamaican. And then you have, of course, the diced tomatoes. Make sure they're kosher for Passover. Tablespoon or 2 of brown sugar, a teaspoon of prepared horseradish or more, you know, depending on how you like it. 2 cups of chicken, beef, or vegetable stock. Kosher for Passover, once again. 2 bay leaves, a sprig of thyme, 2 large red onions. So basically, you take all those spices and you rub it into the meat and the garlic and all of it, and you just let it sit as long as it can, 4 hours, overnight, whatever you got. And then you take 2 teaspoons of that spice mixture and save it for the vegetables. What do you do with every brisket? You put the oil in the pan, you sear it. You sear it on both sides, you remove it from the Dutch oven, you set it aside. You take your onions, your bell peppers, your tomatoes, everything. You saute the onions till they're translucent. Then you add your tomatoes and bell pepper, and you basically just stew it up for 5 minutes. You have the sugar, the stock, the horseradish, the bay leaf, the thyme, and then you pour that out. Just put it in the bowl. You place the onions at the bottom of the Dutch oven and put a little more olive oil on top of that. Put the brisket on top of that and take everything else. Put that on top of that. Cover it. Put it in a 350-degree oven for 3.5 hours until the brisket is fork tender. And then never just eat a brisket out of the pot. You know this. This is the cardinal rule. You take it out, you let it cool, let it come down to room temperature, or you refrigerate it, do your food safety rules. And then you basically let it chill, and then you can remove the excess fat. Then you slice it against the grain, always against the grain. And then you heat that sauce up. You put your brisket in another kind of pan or container. You pour the sauce on top of it, you warm it up, and bam, you got a slamming Seder dish.
My man, Michael Twitty, thank you so much, and happy Pesach to you.
Thank you. Chag Sameach v'Kasher.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Morgan Barber, Monifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.